Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today, Anya Turner, writes under the name Anya Stork. She was born in Russia in 1973. She lived through the Cold War era and the collapse of the Soviet Union. She studied Russian language and literature at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. Then she migrated to the United States in 1994 and became a student at California State University, Chico. Anya Stork got a bachelor's degree in political science, international relations, and a master's degree in communications and education.
As a little child, I didn't think my place of birth was unusual. My family simply lived there in Soviet Russia. Our home was in a typical Stalin-era building in a large provincial town, Voronezh, about 12 hours south of Moscow by train, halfway between Russia and Ukraine. In a small plaza near our home, a department store sculpture depicted the end of World War II. Stalin held a little girl in his arms, while hordes of joyous Soviet citizens looked up at him and cheered. Even though I was born 20 years after Stalin died and 28 years since the end of World War II, we still were surrounded by countless buildings and monuments that depicted Stalin and heroic scenes of decorated World War II Russian soldiers as their centerpieces. Grandpa Andrei and Babushka Polina talked about the war events as if they all happened yesterday. Perhaps this focus on the war occurred because so many battles were on our land, with at least 20 million deaths due to the war and some 30 million other deaths due to Stalin's repressive regime occurring about the same time. After I immigrated to the United States, I took a history course at the community college in Northern California, and I was very surprised to learn that, quote, Russia also participated in World War II, end quote. The American textbook had no mention of the long 5 years of war on Russian soil against German invaders. Neither was there any mention of the horrendous Russian casualties during the war.
This is my guest, Anya Stork, and she's reading from her memoir, Once Upon a Soviet Child, Piano, Potatoes, and Privations. Anya Stork, welcome.
Nancy, thank you for having me here.
You know, you were surprised at what you heard in a history course here in the United States.
Yes.
That Russia also participated in World War II.
Of course, I imagine that in Russia we had a similar perspective with very little mention of American involvement. In fact, during Soviet era, as I was growing up, there was hardly any mention of America helping in World War II. Toward the end of the World War II, there was significant American help, from what I understand, including Russian soldiers. They were very hungry in trenches, and what kept them going into battle was the American canned food, the beef. But we grew up knowing nothing about that. It was part of propaganda.
In fact, nearly every page I would turn in your book, I would think, oh my goodness, I had no idea. I knew a little bit, but I didn't know the extent of what you went through, you and your family went through when you were growing up. And you start, it's almost humorous, you start your book with what it's like when a baby is born, and you, for example, and you have some lovely illustrations, and you have illustrations of little babies in swaddling clothes. And people thought, oh, that's sweet, swaddling clothes. But I was shocked. What was it like when, for example, when you were born, how were you treated as a baby?
Soviet Russia was a very traditional society. Children were not allowed to speak up, and children had no rights. Humans had no rights. In fact, human rights were considered a Western propaganda. So,
but I was shocked that it wouldn't occur to people that maybe babies would like to move their arms and legs. And you were not allowed to do that. You were wrapped so tightly that your arms and legs were not able to move.
Yes.
And
it's to restrict the baby movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's how, and it wasn't just for a couple of days. It wasn't when you were just newborns.
Months.
Months. A baby was wrapped up like that, unable to move its arms and legs.
They would release the blanket, the wrapping, to allow baby to move a little bit, 2-3 times a day for a few minutes, and then wrap them back.
Yeah, so I found, golly. And then they were told when they had the baby had to be potty trained. And by age one, they had to be potty trained by age one, because then they sent the mother back to work.
Absolutely. It was illegal for women to stay home with babies and toddlers and keep bonding. And by law, everybody had to return to work when baby turned one.
So that included your mother. Your mother has you, and when you get to be 1 year old, you had to be potty trained, and she had to go back to work.
Yes.
And these were the days when there was no such thing as disposable diapers.
There were no diapers.
Well, speaking of your mother then, what kind of career did, what kind of work did she go back to?
So mom was a mathematician. She was what's in Russia called an engineer, which is equivalent of American computer programmer. And she was working on those old-fashioned big mainframe machines called
IBM machines.
IBMs. They were as tall as this room.
So your mother had a rather important career, a mathematician and computer programmer?
Yes.
My goodness. So she went back to work after you were born?
Yes.
And this whole situation was not anything you had control over. Even the families did not. They were told what to do. Now, I found it interesting that you describe, for example, what it was like when you had to do laundry. You're a little kid. You've got photographs in your book that are really, I just love your photographs. So you have a picture of you as a little tiny girl, and you're looking out under a bunch of laundry. So would you read us that section
in
your book,
sure,
about Russian-style laundry?
Yes, I love it. Most of the year, except for the summertime, when clothes could be dried entirely outside, our living room looked like a giant spider web, strapped with ropes crisscrossing each other for us to eventually enjoy a pair of clean pants, shirt, or sweater. Sweaters took the longest to dry. The logistics of Soviet laundry was one of the primary reasons Russian people preferred to wear the same clothes day after day, week after week, without washing them.
Therefore, now that seems
we smelled.
Yeah, seems very uncomfortable for those of us here in the States.
In Russia, even today, it's quite common to walk around and see the balconies full of ropes with very personal laundry items secured by pins. Big men's pantaloons or trunks hanging for the entire community to see, bras, panties, shorts, and skirts, as well as children's clothes of various sizes. And I grew up without a washing machine, and my grandma had an awkward apparatus, a clothes wringer, but my parents didn't, so we would wring clothes by hand.
So you would get pretty strong squeezing the water out of your laundry.
I was very strong.
My guest is Anya Stork, and she has written a memoir, Once Upon a Soviet Child, Piano, Potatoes, and Privations. And we haven't really touched on the privations, but there were a lot of those that we here in the States find hard to, we found it hard to cope with some of the privations that you had. And you have a section where you describe going grocery shopping with your dad. And we grow to like your dad in reading about him. And your mother was, she was an independent woman, shall I say?
Mom couldn't really shop as much as we could because of her back injury. So Dad and I, we did most of the grocery shopping and hauling by hand.
And so why don't you read that section in your book where you go grocery shopping with your dad?
Yes, shopping with father. One of my most profound childhood memories was shopping with my father. Russian shopping was a physically demanding task requiring heavy lifting and walking for miles with heavy bags. Also, due to the endless lines, it was time-consuming. Traditionally, women did most shopping, but my mother hated shopping, and my father often relieved her. My father was the primary grocery shopper in our family, and he was one of the best shoppers, knowing how to find us the best deals. Shopping in Russia was tricky. There were no plastic bags or plastic wrapping at the grocery stores. There was no foam packaging. Many Soviet foods and goods were sold by measure and weight and not prepackaged. For example, if you wanted to purchase some cheese, butter, or sausage, the salesperson would weigh it for you on the scale and wrap it in gray Soviet recycling paper or the newspaper. In other cases, there was no wrapping. The grocer handed the customer even the messiest grocery items such as poultry and meat over the counter, unpacked, blood dripping. Additionally, the customer service in the stores was often poor, if not abusive, and not customer-oriented.
So this is my guest, Anya Stork, describing what it was like to go grocery shopping when she went shopping with her dad. And it was kind of a messy experience, it sounds like, Anya. So you mentioned in this paragraph some of the things that you would shop for, and some of the staple foods, bread, butter, cheese, we buy those. Probably not as many potatoes and cabbage. So what would you do with these items that we might not do here in the States?
Well, most of Russian diet up to this day, we have lots of root vegetables. And in Soviet Russia, we had to be very creative. It was what you might call a mono diet. We didn't have many fruits and vegetables. We had certain staples, beets, cabbage, potatoes, onions were the primary ones. And every day we ate soup, Russian soup with beets and cabbage called borscht. We would eat it for lunch. We would often eat it for dinner. It was a staple, along with what's called black bread. That's Russian rye bread.
Well, I think you might, I mean, I'm sure people know that where you were living, it was a very cold climate. And so you were limited in the food items. And you mentioned the root vegetables. And you also, in passing, you mentioned fruits. And what was your experience, say, with apples?
There was very little fruit, Nancy. There was a traditional drink during Soviet times called kompot, where they would put apples that were previously dried during summertime, fall time. They would slice and dry the apples. And in the wintertime, they would boil those dried apples with sugar. And on occasion, if you were lucky, there were pieces of pear, also sliced and dry, or dry prunes, plums, added to that sweet drink.
And here, if I want to get an apple, I just walk in my local grocery store and get an apple. There is no line to get the fruits and vegetables. And, you know, I think I recall seeing photographs of Russians having to wait in long lines, but well, your parents didn't have time for that, so they would send you.
Oftentimes, yes.
And where did you encounter these long lines?
Everywhere, just about everywhere, Nancy, yes.
So, for example, if they liked you, they might give you an apple that was less rotten.
Yes, or if you had privileges, if you bribed the salesperson, which was a common practice too.
How would you bribe, say, somebody who was handing out the apples?
I think they did it secretly. might come in through the back door, or somebody that salesperson knows because they exchange privileges. That was common practice.
My guest is Anya Stork, and her book is Once Upon a Soviet Child. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author Anya Stork. Her book is Once Upon a Soviet Child. And the name Anya is one that you've had since you were born. Were you named for any family member, or your family just liked that name?
They liked that name. My dad named me that. He comes from a Jewish family, and by some reason he liked that name, Anna, short version as Anya.
Well, I was interested in that, too, because I have close friends who named their daughter Anya, and he said that the name means gracious and merciful.
Yes, Anna means grace.
So I thought that was very sweet that your parents gave you that name. Now, speaking of children being born, you were not privileged to know, and we do this here in the United States too. Oh, the stork brought you. That's how you were born. A stork brought you. And you chose that name to write under the name Stork. Is there any relationship there?
Good question, Nancy. Yes, stork, storks bring in the babies. That was the Soviet symbol of the reproduction, the official version of it. And our culture was full of myths. And that was one of them.
It was a myth. This is how babies were created.
Yes.
They were delivered by storks.
Because in Soviet Russia, they couldn't say. It was a very Puritan culture, and we didn't have the word sex, and there was nothing as to that. No explanations, no sexual education, but there were those postcards or cards people would send to each other that depicted a bird, stork, bringing the babies. And I thought that was cute.
So you to pick chose as a name, that as your the name you
as
write
a symbol,
under.
Yeah, to bring the knowledge about those times, because we lived behind a closed curtain to open up that side of history to American audience.
You say at one point, because there was no sex in the Soviet Union. Of course, you're saying that tongue in cheek, but that was that was all you were told, was that storks brought you.
Yes.
And you were how many children were there in your family?
Nancy, we were a very unusual family because we had six children in our family, but most Russians during Soviet times, they would only have one. And after much thought and consideration and counting their pennies, kopecks, they might decide to have a second child.
And
it was very difficult.
A kopeck is how much? We know rubles.
Much less than a penny.
Yeah. So your parents had more children than was typical.
Yes.
There in Russia. But also what was common, well, not birth control pills.
No, I'm sorry to say that this is a harsh Soviet reality fact, that the most common form of birth control in Russia was abortion. for many women, women, unfortunately.
That was sad. And that included your mother?
Unfortunately, yes.
My guest is Anya Stork, and her book is a memoir about growing up in the Soviet Union. The title is Once Upon a Soviet Child, Piano, Potatoes, and Privations. And we've somewhat touched on the privations, and you mentioned the potatoes. And your mother was a good cook, you say?
She was an excellent cook.
She was a mathematician, but she also had these home skills. Were girls taught these skills to be a good wife?
So around fourth grade, we got separated, and boys went onto the classroom to learn about woodworking and working with metals, and girls went into the classroom to learn how to cook and sew. And that was called homemaking skills class.
Well, even when I was growing up, that was true, that the girls took home economics, and the guys went to the workshop.
Yes.
So I think both of your grandmothers could sew and were good seamstresses.
One for sure was a professional seamstress, and the other grandma, it's her mom, my great-grandma, was a professional seamstress before the revolution and shortly after.
And I spent a long time looking at the photographs of your ancestors, your grandparents, great-grandparents that you include, because some of this is hard to believe. My gosh, what a family you had, Anya. And for example, you talk about one of your grandparents and all the medals he won in World War II. And you don't just say that. You've got a photograph showing your grandfather and the medals that he won in World War II.
Yes, both grandfathers were highly decorated military men.
So when you were growing up, you had a lot of expectations.
Yes.
And you were the oldest child. Now, what were your responsibilities as the oldest child?
Just about everything an adult person would do around the house, except mom wouldn't let me run the kitchen as much. But everything else, cleaning, washing the floors, taking out the trash, doing the laundry, and as babies and younger siblings were growing up, washing cloth diapers by hand in a bathtub. Also, grocery shopping, as we mentioned.
Now you also are responsible for, you had a younger sibling that you had to make sure he made it to school. So, and school kids walked to school.
Yes.
So what was your experience in making sure your brother got to school?
The school was fortunately next door. That was an easy short walk, but I did pick up my younger brother from preschool a few times when I was 7 years old and he was five.
A seven-year-old.
And that was a considerable walk across town.
So you make the point that you were treated as an adult. And one time that was used as an excuse for something that was rather unpleasant for you. What happened to your bicycle? Because a bicycle was very important to you. What happened to your bicycle, Anya?
Oh, my bicycle. We had two bikes, and unfortunately, my brother's bike got stolen. He left it at the store. And so my parents couldn't afford a second bicycle, but they knew that I wanted to play an instrument. I wanted to play piano. And I don't know how, but they got me this huge piano. Somebody must have donated it.
And your family's living in a very small space.
Yes.
But this piano got some of the space there in
yes,
your home.
Yes, it was incredible. They muscled that piano there. And after I came home from summer pioneer camp one day, they said, well, guess what? Here's your piano. You can now play the piano, but we're giving your bike to your younger brother. and
left his bicycle where it got stolen.
The second bicycle got stolen too.
And how long was it?
Just a few days, and it got stolen.
A few days after he gets your bicycle, it gets stolen.
I'm still very upset about that.
But, yeah, that sounds like it. But you now have a piano.
Yes.
And you did want to learn music.
Yes.
So what was your experience with music school? And I say music school because it wasn't just lessons. I mean, when I was growing up, I had piano lessons, but I didn't go to music school.
Well, that was the thing about Soviet culture, that there were no exactly like hobbies, like in America. If somebody wanted to pick up a skill, they would start training the child more or less professionally. So the music school was more geared toward children continuing on in the music field and possibly either going into music conservatory as professionals or to teach at the music school as a music teacher.
Well, the music teacher that you had, how did you get along with her?
She was a very strict lady, very professional as far as her skills. She was incredible musician, and she was gearing me up for the music conservatory, only I did not know. I thought I was playing piano because I liked the music.
And you comment on the fact that it's all classical music. Because when I took piano lessons, that's what we played. We played classical music. And so if I wanted to play Over the Rainbow, I had to learn that on my own.
Yes.
But this was, it was very strict classical music, and you were not, you didn't even have access to some other form. What were the other forms of music that you would have liked to have played if you had your choice?
Sometime I heard other music that came from the West. Our TV was broken a lot, but sometime when it was not broken, and we would watch some movies, there were elements where music played was Western, and it sounded like early jazz or ragtime.
And so you would have liked to have played some ragtime
on
the piano.
Or even some popular music that was on the radio sometime.
And you say, and your music teacher was named Flora,
yes.
And she was quite strict. But she didn't treat you quite like she treated the others. How was that different? How did she treat you differently than our other students?
She was pretty strict with everyone. And if somebody showed a lot of promise, she would relax. But normally, and it's just not Flora, but corporal punishment was commonplace in Russia, both in public school and in musical school and in other fields. I imagine in sports too. So
yeah,
she would beat her hands.
I'd be surprised that physical punishment, corporal punishment, on the part of a music teacher.
Yes.
What would she do?
It was very difficult for me to watch other kids being beaten and slapped.
Beaten,
mm-hmm. Slapped. Pushed, yelled at, and eventually I quit. I just wanted to quit.
And apparently she would hit them on their hands. I mean, they use their hands to play the piano. And she, I guess, with a as I recall, she had a stick that she would hit them with.
With objects, with hands, with with anything. And so I tried to rehearse really hard for her not to get beaten. And then I realized it's not something I really want to do.
So you were a serious piano student.
I was scared of her.
And that played a role. But to live up to her expectations, I was shocked at how much time you spent.
Up to 4 hours per day I had to rehearse to bring her a perfect lesson, yes.
Up to 4 hours of practicing piano a day. Oh, my. I'm not sure whether to compliment you or to say, poor kid, that you were just under the pressure.
There was a lot of pressure to perform, yes. Our whole society was that way.
Yeah. You even say that at one point you found you were moonwalking. And this was not the kind of what we mean by moonwalking today, but in Russian, moonwalking, we call it what?
Sleepwalking.
You started sleepwalking. So what other symptoms did you have of the stress that you were under, Anya?
During my music school years, I remember fainting a few times, losing balance.
Yeah, fainting.
Anxieties were high, but there were no medications, no counseling offered to school children of any sort.
So you had to cope with this on your own.
Did
you talk to your parents about it and say, hey, Mom, Dad, I'm really under stress?
No, because there was no communication. Like here in America, children talk to parents, and it's both ways.
So your parents didn't say, well, Anya, how do you feel about that?
Nobody would ask how you feel or even how are you or are you okay?
Yeah. Well, I grew up, my mother often said, children should be seen and not heard. So I got a little bit of that, but nowhere near what you experienced and other Soviet children experienced. You were not asked how you feel or your opinion. And even the government told your parents what to do.
Yes.
It's the impression I got. My goodness. My guest is Anya Stork. That's the name she writes under. And her memoir is Once Upon a Soviet Child, Piano, Potatoes, and Privations. So now you've mentioned your experience taking piano lessons, and you were a very serious piano student. And did you go up to your teacher and say, hey, Flora, I think I'm going to stop taking piano lessons? Did you do that?
I was so scared of her, Nancy. Eventually, one day, I just didn't show up. And it was very tough on her that one of her best students is quitting her and kind of doing something different. I went, I think at the time I was taking starting to take dance lessons, doing a little bit of ballet, also studying English, and that also took time. And I decided I...
So you didn't sit down with your teacher and say, hey, teacher, I think I'm going to quit taking piano lessons.
Or
even with your parents. You didn't tell them either, right?
Well, they had to know because one day I just stopped going.
But you didn't discuss it with them ahead of time?
No.
Yeah.
No.
You wouldn't have done that. Well, you... Don't discuss things with your parents. Soviet children didn't do this. I mean, it wasn't just you. So I don't want to give the impression that your dad was not a really nice guy because he was very altruistic. When you were going to get to live in this building, there was a lottery, and he drew fifth floor.
Excellent. Because there were 12 floors, and fifth floor would be very desirable.
So the elevator wasn't working?
Oftentimes, the elevator was broken, and people feared living on the 12th floor. Then a woman who drew that lottery for the 12th floor, he saw that woman crying, just crying. And he came up to her and asked her, why are you crying? And she said, well, I drew the 12th floor. It's horrible. He said, let's trade. Mom was so upset.
So he's being nice to this stranger. He doesn't know this woman, but he sees her crying because she was going to have to live on the 12th floor, and you and your he and his family are going to get to live on the 5th floor. So he switches with her. And how did your mother react?
She was terrified. But you know what, Nancy? I think... My father knew that by getting onto that 12th floor, we would also have a spectacular panoramic view of Moscow. And so whenever they were shooting fireworks, it was just amazing. We could see 30 different spots where fireworks were going.
So it turned out to be a rather nice place to live. After a break, Anya and I will be back to... discuss Once Upon a Soviet Child, her memoir about growing up in the Soviet Union. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Anya Turner, who writes under the name Anya Stork, and she wrote a memoir about growing up in the Soviet Union. Now, something that was a problem a lot of the time when you were growing up, we have homeless, but in the Soviet Union, it was beyond that. They were just too much vodka. Yes? So what was the problem there?
We didn't have homeless. In fact, in Soviet Union, it was illegal not to have a home, not to have a registered place where you officially belong to, apartment, even if it's crowded, you live with many other people, but you had to belong somewhere. And I think that was part of the problem, why so many people drank. We lived in overcrowded environment.
So the Soviet Union made so many things that would shock us as being illegal. But then Gorbachev comes along, and what does he do about the vodka problem?
For a while, there was a dry law.
A dry law.
People hated him.
I guess so.
And then they had to relax about that.
So drinking vodka became illegal.
For a short time, yes.
Yeah. So he got criticized for that. And speaking of Gorbachev, you say there was a period of time where these Soviet leaders were dying all within a short period of time. And I was interested in your description of Brezhnev.
Mm-hmm.
And what got to be the problem with him?
Yes, I grew up with Brezhnev, and I feel kind of bad for him because I think he was used. He was very old. And he could have stepped down a long time ago, but they kept using him. And he could barely read his speeches. So there are many Soviet anecdotes about that and how he
Didn't he have a stroke?
Eventually, yes. I think he was presiding for 30 years or almost 30 years, one of the longest positions in history. Well, now, of course, Putin beat him.
And so if he could speak very clearly and they maybe dementia. And so here, Gorbachev then, we mentioned him, but this period of time when this was in the early to mid-1980s that the Soviet leaders began to die. So Brezhnev, and then who followed Brezhnev?
It was either Andropov or Chernenko, and they both died really fast, one after another. It was very bizarre.
So the Communist Party were losing the people who were in charge.
Yes.
But now you and other young people were trained in military skills. You had to shoot a rifle?
Yes, Kalashnikov.
So how did that come about?
People here in America often ask me, what was our military preparedness like if we feared the United States? Of course, we were fearful, and I was grown up with that fear. And our military preparedness, in fact, I bookmarked this section in a bomb shelter, drills in a Soviet bomb shelter. It wasn't just going under the desk to hide
from a nuclear.
Not here
in the States.
Yes.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. kids were saying, well, in mm-hmm. case of a threat, crawl under your desk.
Each week, the 40 students in our class continued practicing with the rubber, really real military respirators between sewing the cloth masks. To save ourselves from Americans, we would wear gas-inhibiting respirators. My classmates and I looked at each other through large openings of our respirators. We all looked like little elephants with trunks with gas tubing attached to our respirators, or like the evil characters from Star Trek.
Well, do you know, your illustrator drew a picture of what you just described. That's one of the scariest things I ever saw. And I'm guessing that's you behind this mask, that you're breathing a respirator, and you had to learn to sew your own masks?
Yes. In the second grade, we learned how to quickly sew cloth masks, марлевые повязки, to cover our mouth if chemical weapons were used against us. We made them by hand by folding cheesecloth multiple times. Then we stitched the ends and attached a string to tie them behind our heads. As a military teacher explained, you would use those cloth masks, you would quickly make them if we ran out of respirators.
My guest is Anya Stork. She goes by that name when she writes. In Chico, she's known as Anya Turner. Her memoir is Once Upon a Soviet Child, Piano, Potatoes, and Privations. And she had to learn military skills. And I was surprised. Here you are, a little kid, and you have to shoot a rifle. And what kind of problems did you run into? For example, how did you shoot a rifle, Anya?
We had to lie down on a mat and shoot the target in front of us. And I was so short-sighted. I had really thick glasses. It was very hard for me. And also the school uniforms for girls, they were so tight. So they were
restrictive
and not individualized. It was very uncomfortable.
Well, also, the guys, I mean, their normal uniform is to wear pants, but you, as a girl, you were not allowed to wear pants.
No, we were not allowed
pants. Even when you were lying there shooting a rifle, you had to wear a skirt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how were you with a rifle?
Sometime I got lucky.
But you were not the best marksman.
No.
You know what? I liked the fact you included because everything was about competition.
Yes.
When you were growing up. But there was one friend you had, Natasha. She didn't worry about that. And she sounds like such a nice friend to have because she, like when she was taking piano lessons. And how did Natasha differ from the way you were coping, if I may put it that
yes,
way?
I have to explain that, Nancy, that there were two programs in the musical school. You could attend it full time during the day after regular school and take all the classes, music notation, choir, specialty, mine was piano. Or you could attend it part time, except you wouldn't be able to go into any kind of serious professional program. So that was also an option, and it was kind of looked down upon, and most parents didn't even allow it. It was more like playtime. It wasn't very popular. But some children would attend for less hours and just play the musical instrument without pressure to perform in concert halls or whatnot. There was that option too.
So it seemed to me in reading it that Natasha was kind of a role model for you, saying, look, you can take it easy. You can do it just for pleasure. You don't have to punish yourself and be strict with yourself. So did you switch then because of Natasha's example?
No, I didn't know it was an option for me. I didn't know it was an option until I was almost about to quit.
Well, you include in your book a section about how reluctant Russians are to say, I love you. Your parents didn't tell you that. Your grandparents didn't tell you that. So did Russians ever say, I love you? Would you read that section in your book, Anya?
Yes. Russian, I love you. In Russia, people don't say, I love you, casually in their everyday life, like in America. They don't use it as a goodbye on the phone or in place of, okay, see you later. The Russian I love you is heavily loaded with intense emotions and is said once or twice in a lifetime. It's a solemn, almost sacred expression, intimate and as meaningful as life and death itself. Because of the seriousness of this expression in Russia, few people say I love you to anyone, not even to their mother, their spouse, or their child. I love you in Russian Soviet culture meant two things. One meaning is for courtship, to express powerful feelings when one falls in love. In other words, usually in a marriage proposal. Once having said it to their partner, Russian people don't go around repeating it down during their lifetime. That's how profoundly serious this expression is for Russian soul. Having said, I love you once, they will spend the rest of their life proving it with action without need for verbal repetition, as actions speak louder than words. In other relationships, such as friendships or parent-child relationships, hearing I love you was almost non-existent between friends, unless they were engaged lovers, or between parents and children. The most common situation where people would say, I love you, occurred when a relative or loved one was dying. That was the time to confess. The meaning of the Russian I love you is that I will die for you if necessary.
This is my guest, Anya Stork, and she's reading from her memoir. And it was about her growing up in Soviet Union, once upon a Soviet child, piano, potatoes, and privations. I was intrigued by your book, and I was thinking, okay, well, what happened next? What happened next? And then I come to the last page, and it says, to be continued. So I will look forward to the continuation of your story, because we have you're leaving us so many questions. You did give a hint, though. Your mother was such a good cook that you might just get around to writing a recipe book of your mother's recipes.
I put a few of mom's recipes on my website, anyastork.com.
Well, thank you, Anya, for writing this book and enlightening us about what it was like in Soviet Russia. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
Again, my guest has been Anya Stork, her memoir, Once Upon a Soviet Child. Piano, Potatoes, and Privations. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Find the string that's out of tune. My heart is a mahogany instrument, ancient, reddened by her hair and California wines, musical after twilight. Durable because the songs it plays were here before the first wind spoke love's name. My frets were always with me because language requires a home of labor, paternal worry, and recuperative silence. My heartstrings have learned to play together, though each carries a ragamuffin note. Guy Clark tuned his guitar like a cardiac surgeon who delights in the mischief of an ornery muscle. He knew rhythms are unstable, wounds are lessons, and scars are infallible memories. His credo, find the string that is out of tune and make the rest of the strings match its timbre. My melodies are sugary because of Dr. Pepper, warm because of my good fortune, and rhapsodic because women have cradled me and plucked the magic from my holy center. This is Robert Chansey.
The Round Table. My desire is for all my family to come together for a meal cooked from a recipe I text my husband at work so he can look forward to it all day, say, hey, what's cooking? Smells delicious when he walks through the door. and I finish my office report. My daughter Sophie turns off her Zoom music class, and we group hug like we just played a good game that day. Then her brother comes in from skateboarding, fist bumps Sophie, does not ignore her, stare at her as though she is an empty plate. My parents, vaccinated, stuck and stuck again, smile at each one of us. Do not jump when Sophie makes her happy sounds that don't sound happy. Gather together like King Arthur's knights to do battle against evil, floating, seen and unseen in the world. Sit down at a table with no one at the head or on the end, just a circle of grace. Joan Goodrow.
The mistake of waiting. The mistake most commonly made by those asked to wait is to focus on that which has not yet happened. The anticipation of action, the expectation of the event, the anxiety of delay. These obscure the truth of waiting, which is a radiant stasis. He knows what he's waiting for. He knows it's coming, sooner or later. He just doesn't know exactly when or how or what happens next. These are the things he thinks about, but that is precisely his mistake, to focus on a mysterious future, a thing at once terrifying and banal, and not on the wait itself. He will be waiting for a good while yet. He ought to turn his attention accordingly. There is only the waiting itself, for which there is no wait. The truth of waiting is that one should endeavor to do only that, without expectation or desire. Accept this bright parade of moments. It is your story now. Rob Davidson.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.